asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. The US State Department is warning its staff in China to look out for any hearing or sight issues after one employee complained of mystery symptoms. The US has previously said diplomats in Cuba had displayed similar symptoms after suspected sonic attacks. The staff member in China suffered what's described as mild traumatic brain injury working in the Guangzhou consulate. American author Philip Roth has died at the age of 85. The Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist was a preeminent figure in 20th century literature. US correspondent Kate Fisher reports.
Philip Roth first found success with his short story collection Goodbye Columbus, published in 1959. He went on to publish more than 30 books, including Portnoy's Complaint, I Married a Communist, The Human Stain, and American Pastoral, before ending his fiction career in 2009. His often dark comic writing examined the Jewish experience, sex, and life in America. The New York Times reported that his close friends said he died of congestive heart failure. Kate Fisher, Washington.
The German city of Hamburg's announced bans on older diesel vehicles on two streets, which will affect more than 100,000 drivers in the city. It's the first German city to ban diesel vehicles after a landmark court ruling earlier this year. Ira Spitzer reports from Berlin.
The diesel bans will go into effect on May 31st and will be in force on stretches of a little over 2 kilometers on two streets. On one of those streets, all diesel vehicles that do not meet the Euro 6 emission standards will be forbidden from driving. Well, the second ban applies to older diesel trucks. Over 60% of the city's more than 200,000 diesel vehicles will be affected by the ban. Germany's top administrative court ruled in February that cities can use diesel bans to combat air pollution, a blow to German car makers, as well as the federal government, who have sought to avoid the bans. Ira Spitzer, Berlin.
Australia's Archbishop of Adelaide, Philip Wilson, says he'll stand aside but not yet resign after being convicted of covering up child sexual abuse during the 1970s. From Melbourne, Arthur Stevens reports.
The 67-year-old was this week found guilty in Newcastle local court north of Sydney of failing to report to police the repeated abuse of two altar boys by paedophile priest James Fletcher in the New South Wales Hunter region. He's the most senior Catholic official in the world to be charged with concealing child sexual abuse and faces a maximum 2 years jail. In a statement issued by the Catholic Church, Wilson said it was appropriate to stand down in light of Magistrate Robert Stone's findings. In his statement, he also says that if at any point in time it becomes necessary or appropriate for him to take more formal steps, including by resigning as Archbishop, then he will do so.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Well, thank you very much, Ollie Barrett. Thank you. Welcome to Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. How are you? Hope you're well. Another glorious day in the great city of Manchester. What a beautiful day it's been. How long is this going to last? Welcome to the programme. It's going to be an interesting one. Tweet at Richie Allen Show now.
Join in tonight's discussion by tweeting at Richie Allen Show now.
Yeah, what she said.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, we might have Charlie Robinson on the program this evening. We might not, though. I hope we do, but if we don't, we'll have him on either tomorrow or early next week. He's written a book called The Octopus of Global Control, and it's hugely, hugely interesting. He sent me a copy of it earlier. I've been poring over it this afternoon. Really, really top read this is. Agreed to come on. He's excited about coming on. I'm excited about having him on. But late this afternoon, he asked me, could we possibly do it by cell phone as he might not be back at his office? So I've said, look, no, let's not do an hour-long discussion over cell phone for obvious technical reasons. So I don't know if he's going to be on or not. If he's not, don't worry about it. We'll roll with the punches and we'll do something else. But if he is, all the better. It is the 23rd of May, 2018. This is your Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2. Triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio, and of course, richieallen.co.uk. What a day it's been. As we approach 5 minutes past the hour, as we do it live. Live, we are live. If you're listening to the podcast that isn't live, don't tweet the program. Ever. Outside of the live show. Alrighty. Yeah, so if Charlie comes on, good stuff, as we say, awalia, back home. If he doesn't, well, we'll get him on early next week. Can't not mention this. I don't do things like this very often. This sort of thing would have been frowned upon in the days when I was a commercial radio presenter and producer. But my soulmate and my longtime fiancé is 40 today. 40. 40. Ivra Dahad. She's 40. Is Caroline Tisserant, my fiancé. She's an extraordinary woman. Intelligent, talented, loves life, loves people. Touched everyone who's ever met her. Ran a bar in Spain for many years and was beloved. Was loved by everyone who knew her there. Going to wrap this up very quickly before it gets a little bit sickening for you. But the best day of my life was meeting her back in Waterford in 2002. The best day of my life. She's in Nancy, which is her hometown in the east of France. It's slightly southeast, is it? Or is it slightly northeast? It's almost parallel with Paris on the east. It's near Metz. And she's there today with friends and family celebrating her 40th. Quite right too that she's there with her family and friends. Happy birthday, our kid. She'll grab the podcast tomorrow morning undoubtedly and will hear this and will be embarrassed. I would love to be with her, of course, but because of our dog Jazz, it's impossible. Jazz is a rescue dog, beautiful creature, but has a lot of trauma, can't be put in kennels, can't be placed with friends or family because she just won't stay with them. And that's just the way it is. So I'm not in the wonderful city of Nancy today. But of course I'm thinking about the woman who, well, has made me maybe slightly better than what I was. Anyway, shall we move on? Move on quickly, Richie. It's sickening. All right, I'll move on. Well, well, well. Guess who just breezed in the door? Yulia Skripal. Eh? Yulia Skripal has surfaced and has said that she feels lucky to have survived being poisoned and that she would one day like to return home to her native Russia. Ms. Skripal, who was poisoned in March in Salisbury, I'm reading now from Sky and from the BBC, I'm not sure she was poisoned. I know you're not sure that she was poisoned. But anyway, we'll just go along with the narrative for the moment. She said, "We are so lucky to have both survived this attempted assassination. Our recovery has been slow and extremely painful." This is Sky News at 6 p.m. British Summer Time today, breaking the story.
Hello, good evening. Yulia Skripal has spoken on camera for the first time since she and her father survived a nerve agent attack in Salisbury. She's described her recovery as slow and painful. She's rejected the Russian embassy's offer of assistance, but says she does want to return to Moscow.
Добрый день. Меня зовут Юлия Скрипаль. Я приехала в Великобританию 3 марта навестить своего отца, как я и делала ранее.
Good day. My name is Yulia Skripal. I came to the UK on March 3rd to visit my father, something I've done before. After 20 days in a coma, I woke to the news that we may have been poisoned. I still find it difficult to come to terms with the fact that both of us were attacked in such a way. The fact that a nerve agent was used to do this is shocking. We are so lucky to have both survived this attempted assassination. I don't want to describe the details, but the clinical treatment was invasive, painful, and depressing. Our recovery has been slow and extremely painful. I am grateful to all of the wonderful, kind staff at Salisbury Hospital, a place I have become all too familiar with. I also think fondly of those who helped us on the street on the day of the attack. I was discharged from hospital on April 9th and continued to progress with treatment, but my life has been turned upside down. As I try to come to terms with the devastating changes thrust upon me, both physically and emotionally, I take one day at a time and want to help care for my father until his full recovery. In the longer term, I hope to return home to my own country. I wish to address a couple of issues directly and have chosen to interrupt my rehabilitation to make this short statement. I ask that everyone respects the privacy of me and my father. We need time to recover and come to terms with everything that has happened. I'm grateful for the offers of assistance from the Russian embassy, but at the moment, I do not wish to avail myself of their services. Also, I want to reiterate what I said in my earlier statement, that no one speaks for me or my father but ourselves. I would like to thank again everyone involved in my continued care in this difficult period of my life. My priority remains on my recovery and my father's health. Thank you for your attention.
Well, how interesting. Apparently, she was filmed somewhere near London. Very nice, pretty, scenic area. Wooded area, I would say. She looks the picture of health, does Yulia. She's an attractive woman. She speaks there very well. Looks, as I said, very well. You know, the picture of health, as I said. Presumably, this footage has been presented to the UK's media by, well, by those who are allegedly protecting the Skripals. This is all very interesting. Of course, Alexander Yakovenko, who's Russia's ambassador to the UK, he's been playing a game of poker with the British authorities, demanding to see some evidence that the Skripals are okay. He even suggested the whole thing was a hoax, that they were never poisoned. He raised the British authorities. Well, it seems that they have seen his raise and they have raised again with this video. Now, undoubtedly, there will be listeners to this programme and listeners to other independent media productions who will say this is all fake, it's all staged, the usual stuff. They might be right, who knows? I just get tired of it. This, it's not real bullshit. We don't know. Anyway, presuming just for the minute that the, you know, that it's a genuine statement from Yulia, Mark White is a Sky News UK Affairs correspondent. Here's his take on Yulia's video and what she had to say.
Yeah, it's a very significant development because it is effectively a proof of life video. The authorities here in the UK, the Skripals themselves, of course, more than aware of the growing speculation that there has been, pushed, of course, forward by the likes of the Russian embassy on whether they were actually poisoned in the first place, whether they may even be alive. So that was part of the motivation behind this statement that Yulia Skripal has given. She has given a statement to show that she is alive, she is recovering, but she has been through a terrible ordeal, as has her father. And she wants to make it clear to people that her first priority is to look after her father. She will be staying here in the UK. This is an undisclosed location where Yulia Skripal and her father are being kept under police guard. Of course, they have been the subject of an attempted assassination plot here. You can see Yulia Skripal signing two letters, one in English and one in Russia, effectively just outlining the statement that she gave to camera there. But the main points of that, apart from the very important point of her being able to show people that she is alive and now recovering, is to say that she one day hopes to return to Russia. But in the meantime, she is rejecting any kinds of call for assistance from the Russian embassy. She says that she is happy. She has been looked after well by the UK authorities and will not avail herself of any help from the Russian government at this stage. But at one time, she says, at some point in the future, she will be looking to return to her home country of Russia.
Now, Mark White there, correspondent. There are tweets on this. Andy Newman tweets, I wonder who Yulia's handlers are. Base Ninja tweets, poisoned or attacked by a nerve agent? Which was it? For me, tweets Base Ninja, I wouldn't describe the use of military-grade nerve agents as poison, more like weapons of mass destruction. You know what, guys? I think that whole story is fell apart within a few days of it emerging. The Skripals were not poisoned or were not attacked with a nerve agent by agents of the Russian state. It's just not true. It's a nonsense. I think we all agree on that. No, that whole story has fallen to pieces. Patsy Cline, anyone? I fall to pieces. David Stanford tweets, afternoon or good evening, David. Isn't it wonderful when you only have the words of a lamestream employee translator? That's a good point. Yulia Skripal has been in the country for, well, for a number of years now, has lived here, worked here. Why wouldn't she be speaking in English, knowing that she's addressing a UK audience? It might be something of nothing. It's just something that occurred to me 15 minutes past the hour. By the way, Charlie Robinson will be joining me. He'll be joining me at the top of the hour. Good stuff. Looking forward to that. Charlie Robinson at the top of the hour. He's got a terrific book out that we want to talk about. Keep the tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Dean tweets, what happened to the bloke who, the reporter who said they should be left to die in peace? This story just has too many anomalies. That's right. It was reported right across the board that they weren't likely to live, and one of Sergei Skripal's closest friends, allegedly, was telling Sky News that his understanding was that Skripal wouldn't survive. He was released on the day that that couple got married on Saturday, that national nonsense on Saturday. A lot of people said, well, what a great time to release him even from hospital, because it would just go unnoticed. It was nicely covered by the royal wedding. 16 minutes past the hour. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a very quick break, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Friday's abortion referendum in the Republic of Ireland. I'd always planned on doing something on it this week. I hadn't spoken much about it before now. Maria Heller and I spoke a bit about it a week or so ago, but I want to chat about it because it's very interesting. How it is being reported on is very interesting. What is being said in my country is very interesting as well. It's hugely emotive. I've had emails from people. I had an email from one woman particularly who said that she was disgusted by me, as in your host, that I would be in favour of abortion, that I should know all about depopulation agendas and all of that. I've never said on this programme, ever, or anywhere else, that I am in favour of abortion, ever. So if I have, I'd like somebody to point me in the direction of a piece of audio that proves that. I've never said that at all. I'll tell you where I am on it when I come back. You might find that interesting, you might not. But before that, we're going to hear from some people, and I'm going to explain exactly what is going on in Ireland, just in case you don't know. This is your Richie Allen Show for Wednesday, the 23rd of May, red letter day in my life. Happy 40th birthday to the future Mrs. Allen, to my life partner, my fiance. I'm not going to say that again. Back in a minute with more on the abortion referendum. The pending referendum in Ireland takes place on Friday.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Richie Allen.
Welcome back to the programme. Welcome back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Thanks for joining me. Hope you've had a good day. Hope you're in good form. If you're in the UK, you've enjoyed some absolutely beautiful spring weather. It really is lovely. If it could just be like this. Manchester is one of the greatest places you could ever spend time. One of the warmest in terms of the care and the time that people have for one another. It's amazing. It's like nowhere else I've ever been. And I've been lucky enough in my life to travel all over the world. All over the world. Central America, North America, Africa, Europe. I've seen everywhere. There's nothing like this great city. If you could just get 4 to 6 weeks between June and September every year, like they do in Central Europe, you'd love it. You'd never leave it, is what I'm saying. Dean apologises for his last tweet. Thanks, Dean. It was garbage. Apology. It was grammatically awful. With terrible spelling, says Dean. Get back to school. Don't go back to school. There's an app now, isn't there? There's an app for everything, you know. We're dumbing down to the point that in a few years' time, in a few years' time, teenagers will be absolutely, totally and utterly illiterate. We're dumbing down so much. There's an app now where you can just write like a fucktard. You can write like a fucktard and then run the app over it and it'll clean it all up for you, turn you into Stephen King. Right. That's just wonderful, isn't it? Oh, God. Do you know what? I never brag about my education because it doesn't mean anything. It's rubbish. My education was a waste of time because it was just programming and indoctrination. It was. However, antiquated skills like reading, writing, like grammar, like context, like... Christ. I mean, it's dreadful to think where we're going to be in a few years' time, you know. Right, move on. That actually depresses me, so I'm going to just move straight on. There is a big referendum in the Republic of Ireland this coming Friday. I've been sent a story there from WLRFM.com, my old stomping ground, Waterford's radio station and one of the most successful commercial stations in the country. Two people have been arrested there, apparently, over the anti-abortion referendum. Presumably, they were posting materials that somebody found offensive. I've not got time to read the story now, so I better just crack on. Time is pressing. Thanks to Mr. Mojo for the story anyway. So Irish people on Friday will get the chance to vote on whether they want to keep the law that makes abortion illegal or if they want to repeal it, the Eighth Amendment. Now, Ireland, in case you don't know, has a near total ban on abortion. Terminations, as it stands in Ireland, are only allowed if there is a substantial risk to the life of the mum. And there is a penalty for accessing an illegal abortion. That penalty is 14 years in prison. That's the maximum. Women travel to the UK for a termination. And I think there's about 9 a day, I think. Is it 9 a day or is it 9 a week? It could be 9 a week. Maybe not 9 a day. Maybe 9 a week. I'll try and get that stat right. Maybe it's 9 a week. 9 women a week travel to the UK for a termination. As I said, the law is rooted in the 8th Amendment to the Republic of Ireland's Constitution. That amendment, by the way, gives the unborn child the same right to life as the mother. Voters will choose yes if they want to repeal this amendment, or no, if they want to keep it as it is. So the Irish government has proposed that if people do vote to repeal the Eighth Amendment, women could access a termination within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. Now, that's been hugely, hugely controversial, and it's been contentious, to say the least, in my homeland. People are saying abortion on demand, and that's a phrase, abortion on demand, that's entered the Irish lexicon. It really has. Many who are voting no cite abortion on demand as something they can't support in good conscience. So let's hear a couple of the arguments then. And I'm going to say again, I'm a lot of things. I have a lot of faults. There are things about me which are annoying, and well aware of that, like anybody else. But I am rigidly fair. I am the fairest person that I can possibly be. And I'm going to commend Sky News for their coverage of this issue in the Republic of Ireland. It has been outstanding, particularly a woman called Beth Rigby, who's a roving reporter. She would be known, I suppose, as a hack, which is not a derogatory term either, by the way. She's a very seasoned reporter. Brilliant reporting by Beth Rigby on this. So we're going to hear a couple of the arguments. We're first of all going to hear from Amy Callaghan and her husband. Now, Amy learned very early in her pregnancy that her baby had a condition that meant he effectively had no brain. There was no prospect of life for him. He was going to die upon delivery. There was no doubt about it. She ended up going to the UK for a termination. And you'll hear from Amy, as I said, and also her husband here.
Your first minute of that scan, or your first second, was joy. Like, you know, you see the little blob and you hear the heartbeat, you know it's there. And then I just knew. I knew when she was quiet, when she said nothing, and when she said, is your husband here? I just thought, this isn't good news.
Last year, Amy and Connor were expecting their second child, but at the 12-week scan, their unborn baby, Nico, was diagnosed with a fatal condition called anencephaly, which affects the baby's brain and skull.
She said that it was likely the baby would pass away in utero, that some babies then do go full term, and if they do go full term and you give birth, they're likely to die while you're giving birth, and that if the baby didn't die while he would give birth, it was going to be a few minutes, maybe an hour or two. And I started to think at that stage that that was not a kind way for a baby to die. And I was thinking about myself and having to spend the next 6 months pregnant with people asking me how far along I was. Before all this happened, I would have known that abortion was illegal here. That in most cases, but I thought in a case where it was this severe, where there really wasn't a brain, where a baby was missing most of its brain, and where the amniotic fluid would be wearing the brain down until she died, I really thought they could help more.
I was angry, but I didn't know where to target it, because even, you know, in Ireland, the Irish doctors and nurses, they're totally hamstrung by the law. If they wanted, even if they wanted to help, helping us comes with a 14-year jail sentence, which is crazy. Why should a medical issue come with essentially a jail sentence hanging over it?
Yeah, that's a pretty heartfelt story there. Again, can't imagine it. Can't imagine it, really. You know, we haven't been blessed with children. We love children. But to be told in pregnancy that there's no chance of life, and that the condition which resulted in the skull deformity and the brain being absent, it must be a terrible thing. So they took the decision to go to the UK, because if anybody had assisted them in the Republic of Ireland, as they said, it could have resulted in a jail sentence. So just think on that. We'll now hear from Vicky Wall. Now, Vicky was in a very similar situation to Amy. Vicky was told that her child wouldn't live. Very similar condition, very similar congenital condition. But Vicky explains why she carried on with the pregnancy and why she is very much against abortion. Here's Vicky Wall.
Save the Eighth campaigner Vicky Wall's baby was diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder, Edwards syndrome, at 23 weeks.
I think he knew by my face that abortion would not be an option for us. Wouldn't be now a right to abort her. She was unique and she was a daughter and she was valued to us.
Vicky continued with her pregnancy, but her baby died at 32 weeks.
Leighton died at home, surrounded by her family and with love and with care and most of all with dignity. And I take a massive comfort in that, that she died on her terms.
We've talked about your really difficult choice that you made. Do you feel comfortable in making that choice for other women rather than letting them make that choice for themselves?
Well, we have to look at what the choice entails. What are we saying we have the choice to do? We're looking to have the choice to end a unique human life. And I don't think that choice is a reasonable choice. Bottom line on it would be that I am extremely pro-life and I think life should be protected.
Vicky Wall there, and Beth Rigby, the reporter I mentioned, it was Beth speaking with her there. I really like Beth Rigby. I think she's an excellent reporter. So you have two very articulate, very nice women there who took two different approaches. And again, keep it in mind. Keep in mind what they said. Now, here's a very interesting chat between Sky News presenter Kay Burley, often mentioned on this programme, and a man called John McGurk. Now, John is the communications director of the Save the Eighth campaign. So he's a no campaigner. Pro-life he is. This is very good stuff, this. Again, I give credit where credit is due. This exchange between John McGurk and Kay Burley reminds you, well, it reminds me anyway, of the way news used to be. It's grown up. It's interesting. It's deep. It's thought-provoking. So John McGurk, communications director of Save the Eighth, he votes no on Friday, will vote no, and he's pro-life. Here he is talking with Sky News' Kay Burley. And he first of all talks about some of the issues that the UK has with abortion. Very good stuff.
We're very happy that over the last 20 years, the number of abortions in this country has plummeted from about 6,500 women travelling to the UK for an abortion in 2001 to about 3,500 today. Now, some of that the Yes campaign will point out is in relation to illegal abortion pills, but they account, their best estimate is about 1,500. So we've seen about a 20 to 25% drop in the number of women making that awful and heart-wrenching decision in the last 15, 20 years. And we want to continue that progress. We don't want, with all respect to you, because I'm a huge fan of the UK, but we don't want to import the culture that you guys have over there.
Which is,
you know, in 1 year you had 66 babies born after an abortion left to die on a table, and that was 2007. In 1 year last year in the UK, you had 11 babies injected into the heart and delivered dead because they had a cleft palate. You had 141 children injected into the heart and delivered dead because they were twins and their mothers only wanted one child. And the most horrifying thing about those stories for me, Kay, isn't that they happened, it's that they weren't news at all. That the British public...
Very emotive words, aren't they? And then if I came back to you and said, what about a 12-year-old girl that is raped and then has to undergo the whole 9 months of her pregnancy and then what happens to her and what happens to her baby?
And you know, this is why it's an emotive issue. And those cases do happen. There were three of them out of 3,500 women who had been raped in 2016 who travelled to the UK. And I think if this was a referendum of making provision for those women, we would lose it. And we would lose it comprehensively. But it's not. This is a referendum that has very shamelessly exploited the horrible fate that those women and women with tragic diagnoses in relation to their children have, and used their cases to try and bulldoze in a regime that's a similar, if not more liberal, than the one in the UK.
Okay, let's put that to one side. If you win the campaign on Friday into Saturday, what would you see happen as far as women travelling to the United Kingdom for illegal abortions, illegal here, not there, are concerned? Would you have them not be prevented from travelling?
No, I mean, the law as it stands, we are not voting on changing the law as it stands to make it more restrictive. We're changing to make it more liberal, and we oppose that. We have no desire to prevent the right guaranteed by our European Union membership to travel to any other state for any other reason.
So you would still be content with women travelling overseas
Being content with people travelling to do things
but
that
you
are
wouldn't
in
try
other
to
countries.
Stop them.
Yeah, and trying to prevent them from doing it are two very different things in a democracy. In Western liberal democracies, we don't build walls to keep people in. We don't do that, and nor should we.
That's very good stuff, that. And he said something very interesting to Kay Burley there. He said that if the referendum was about those three cases where women were raped and became pregnant, but then they had to travel to the UK to have a termination. If the referendum was about that, the pro-life non-repeal, excuse me, the pro-life vote no campaign would lose comprehensively. He's pro-life, he's voting no on Friday, but if he said it's about rape, if it was about rape and the right to terminate if you've been raped or abused, they would lose. And again, I want you to keep that in mind, because speaking to my friend and colleague Jean-Anne Crowley, who's in Ireland and who will be voting on this on Friday, I didn't ask her which way she would be voting because it's none of my business. We talked about how this incredibly complicated issue has been tackled by the Irish government in the same ridiculous kind of ham-fisted way that I suppose most governments try to handle these issues. You know, it's in a black and white way, when things are not black and white. Should we repeal the amendment or should we not? That's incredibly simplistic when the issue is not simplistic. And I'm going to tell you where I am on it in a minute. And I'll tell you what I would vote. I'll tell you now the way I would vote, and I'll tell you why in a minute. I would vote no on Friday. I would vote no not to repeal the Eighth Amendment. And I'll tell you why in a minute. And some of my female listeners now might be annoyed by that, but I'm going to explain why in a minute. They're trying to solve this very complicated, multifaceted issue with a simple question. And that's ridiculous. The question isn't broad enough to cover the complexities of it. And I'll tell you why I think that in a minute. John McGurk was excellent there with Burley. And Burley, to her credit today, she's based in Dublin, has been very good in the way she's conducted the interviews with the yes and the no side, has kept her own opinions out of it, and has treated both sides with courtesy and asked them some good questions. Maybe there's hope for Kay yet. Now, Siobhan Donoghue went to Liverpool for a termination in 2012. Again, she found out at 10 weeks, I think, or 11 weeks, that her baby TJ, her boy, the top of his head never formed. The skull just wasn't there. Again, the brain was absent. A terrible thing for a mother, for the father, for the family to learn. She's a yes campaigner. She wants to repeal the Eighth Amendment and she wants terminations to be possible in Ireland. She's a yes campaigner. And here she is with Kay Burley, who asks an intelligent question. After hearing about the, you know, the sound, you could argue, sound reasons why Siobhan wanted to terminate, Kay Burley asked her a pretty intelligent question.
Siobhan, do you accept that your TJ and your circumstance is what's known as a hard case, as I've come to discover here in Ireland? Many other babies, tens if not hundreds of thousands of other babies, will lose their lives in order for cases like yours so that you can abort your baby.
There has been a lot of talk lately about, you know, the hard cases, the cases of fetal anomaly, the cases of rape and incest. And there have been so many stories told, and they're not all the so-called hard cases. There have been many people who have come forward and told their stories, and often have to tell them anonymously because they don't feel able to share their stories. People who have maybe four other children. Maybe they are the only breadwinner in the house. Maybe they have circumstances where they just cannot support or cannot have another child, or they're not ready to have another child. In my mind, those cases are as deserving of the care and compassion as people feel for the hard cases. I don't think, you know, I think it is maybe easier for people to, when they start thinking about this topic, to maybe feel that we should deserve to be looked after. But in my mind, anybody who is facing a situation where their pregnancy has become a crisis for whatever reason deserves the care and compassion, and they should be able to access that in our country.
Right, so Siobhan Donoghue there. So you heard pretty thought-provoking arguments there from both sides. I'll tell you where I am on it. If I was back home, I don't vote. I don't vote in elections. I don't vote in elections because, for reasons that have been discussed too many times on this programme to repeat them again. But referenda. Yeah, I've taken an interest in referenda. I would have voted against the Lisbon Treaty in Ireland, or was it the Nice Treaty? Again, I can't remember. 2000, was it 2001? Might have been Nice. And I voted in the referendum here in June of 2016, but I wouldn't vote otherwise. I would vote no. Now, here's the caveat. How could you tell a woman who's been abused, either abused by a relative, incest, or a woman who has been raped and has become pregnant because of that, how could any society, in good conscience, any country, any government, tell that woman that you must see the pregnancy through to the full term? How can you do that? I don't think it's possible to do that. And although I've got grave reservations about abortion, or abortion on demand, or abortion for people whom are not happy with the sex of the baby. And this actually happens. You know, people just say, well, I didn't want a girl. This actually happens in this country. It might not be widespread. I'm not going to lie or exaggerate and say it's happening all the time, but it does happen. To me, that's grievously wrong, to terminate a pregnancy because the child isn't a boy or a girl, because you wanted the opposite sex. I think it's grievously wrong if you find out that the child has Down syndrome and you decide to terminate. I would privately find that terribly wrong, terribly sad, and I'd be uncomfortable with it. I wouldn't be running after that woman on the street and calling her a murderer or a murderess or shouting at her. But if my counsel was sought, if my opinion was invited, I would say, I think that's terribly wrong. Why would you do that? That's my opinion. I used to chair these debates on radio back home, and we had all sorts of discussions about when is the baby, is the embryo, is the fetus, when is the baby conscious and aware? When is it human? When is it alive? When is it, you know, let's just use that word, conscious. And there are, you know, there are a thousand opinions on that, and I don't know the answer to that. And I know there are people listening to this program with very, very strong opinions about that. I just tell the truth, I don't know. How could you say to the lady who we heard from at the very beginning, Amy Callahan, how could you say to Amy, there's no chance the child is going to live because the brain isn't there, the skull is not there? How can anybody insist you have to see that through to full term or as far as you can get? How could you in good conscience insist that she do that? How could you deny her the rights to a termination? You see, I couldn't deny her the rights to a termination. And this is why I have a huge problem with this referendum, because the question is just a black and white question. It isn't broad. It's not broad enough to possibly encompass all the complexities of this. Abortion's on demand. I know there are people listening to this program who will tell me now that this is part of an agenda. And I agree with them. I don't deny it. I don't want to see abortions on demand. Because that only ends up with, that just creeps and creeps and creeps and creeps. And then you go from 12 weeks to 16 weeks to 24 weeks. And then before you know it, people will introduce laws where it's okay to have abortions after 6 months or 8 months. It's terrible. And I understand why people think about that. But, I don't want to be repeating myself, but like I said, I don't want to see people decide, oh, well, I'm not happy that I wanted a girl, so I'm going to abort. That's terrible. But could you honestly, no matter how pro-life you think you are, could you honestly stand in front of a woman who's been raped, even if it's not the most common case, even if it's one of these so-called hard cases, how could you say to her, you've got to carry the pregnancy through? You see? So it's complex. I would vote no on Friday because I agree with those who say that what this is opening things up to is abortion on demand, with no real discussion of the many, many facets of it and the many reasons why people would want to terminate. It also doesn't cover people whom are shocked by the fact they've become pregnant, are not able for it. At least they don't think they're able for it. You know, you have women who think, geez, I've got a career here. I don't want a child. I didn't want a child. I don't want a child. And they might go ahead and have a termination. But with, I don't mean with counselling, but with a, with access to other services, with access to help and to support, might decide, do you know what? I'm going to give it a go. And then might find out that when they deliver their boy or girl, it changes their life. And it's the most wonderful thing that ever happened to them. But they don't get a chance, or they haven't given themselves a chance to make that decision. They've had no support to make that decision. They just go and get the termination. So it's very hostile in Ireland. You know, most people who talk about these things are very polarised. People don't want to see that there are shades of grey. It's just black and white. If you have a termination, you're a baby murderer. If you're against it, you're anti-women, you're misogynistic. It's bollocks. It's much more complicated than that. I don't want people to be getting abortions for no reason. Or just because, I just don't want to have the baby. Or, well, I wanted a boy. Or I was told the baby is Down syndrome, so I don't want it. I don't agree with that. But if somebody is raped and they don't want to see it through, I'm not going to argue with that woman. If somebody has been abused by her father or an older brother, has become pregnant, can't countenance the idea of carrying the child to term, I can't argue with that either. I'm very interested in your opinion. Tweet at Richie Allen Show, that's at Richie Allen Show, with your thoughts on this pretty complicated issue. Moinga tweets, I also feel the same way about abortion. Then again, it's the woman's decision at the end of the day. Now, Moinga, a lot of blokes would disagree with that. A lot of blokes whom are in or were in a partnership, even if it isn't a marriage, but were cohabiting with a woman, love that woman, they shared their life together, they would say, well, hang on a second, surely I get a say in it. That child is also part of me, even if I'm not carrying it. So they would say, look, I disagree with that. I don't know. I hope I have all this ahead of me in the future. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens on Friday. As it stands, those who wish to repeal the Eighth Amendment and to make abortion legal in Ireland, it looks like they're going to win the day, because the polls are showing at the moment that they have a lead which might be insurmountable. 55-45, depending on which polls you read. Some say 60-40, some say 53-47. Now look, it can't be 53-47, it can't be 60-40, because you've got undecideds as well. But that's what they're projecting for Friday. But those of you who did email me, particularly a woman called Dorothy, I don't know where you got this idea that I'm just pro-abortion. That, you know, people should just go and have a... I'm not. I've never said that. My point of view has always been the one I just expressed. It's complex, it's complicated. You know, it isn't black and white. There are shades of grey. There are reasons why it might be best for a woman not to see out the term. But none of that is taken into account in this referendum. And McGurk, the communications director, was absolutely brilliant speaking to Kay Bordy. He acknowledged that if the referendum was about these specific cases, the no side would lose, because it's common sense. Right, 12 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Going to take another very quick break. This is your Richie Allen Show. We are live. It is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2017.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Welcome back to the program. Thanks for the tweets on this. I'm delighted that so many of you are interested in it. I was wondering about doing this segment. Would people be interested in it? But it's hugely important. Again, because those of us who studied Agenda 21, Agenda 30, the depopulation agenda, we know that there are influences around us that want to open up not only abortion on demand to communities and societies, but these same people want to open up what we used to call mercy killings, euthanasia on demand as well, which again, I've got a huge problem with. Susan, thanks for your tweet. I really appreciate it. Richie, I believe the soul is there with inception, but I also believe it's a woman's choice. I've known women who have had many abortions, been refused via the NHS, and they had to go private. For example, form of idiot contraception, there is never a right way, but it is a woman's choice, says Susan there. But Susan, do you not think that in a stable relationship, do you not think that, yes, you know, obviously the woman is carrying, and again, who can say I have autonomy over your body? Who can deny your sovereign right to do what you think is best for your body? I understand that. But doesn't the bloke that you love and that helped create the life, doesn't he have at least a say in it? Charlotte says, Richie, I used to work in a medical environment, and sadly there were certain women who had abortions for fun rather than take the morning after pill. That's very sad and very frustrating, says Charlotte there. Base Ninja was back on to say, surely it has to be dealt with case by case. Aborting for no reason is bad. Designer babies is maybe part of an agenda. A perfect being, so to speak. A perfect way for population control. That's interesting again. Les Hewitt says, Les, nice to hear from you, by the way. Humans only seem to think of things as black and white. You're right to say it's complicated. It is complicated, Les. It's a very complex issue as well. Dion says, Richie, you have lost a year. It's 2018, I think. Did I say 2017, did I? What a plonker I am if I did. Thanks for that, Dion. Of course, it's 2018. David says, a one-size-fits-all law doesn't fit a case-by-case situation. Although terminating for paltry reasons is pretty heinous. When will that stop, or where will that stop? Hair, eye colour, projected IQ. It shows how throwaway life is in today's society. And that's exactly my sentiment indeed as well. It is 7.5 minutes to the top of the hour. Charlie Robinson is going to join me. I think you're going to enjoy listening to Charlie. Don't go anywhere. You know, I had plenty to talk about because I thought Charlie wasn't going to make it. So I've got loads of stuff here, but I'm not going to get through it. I'll save some of it for tomorrow. Very interesting thing in the news today. Very interesting story about Amazon and facial recognition. Do you remember the brilliant Pippa King? The amazing Pippa King, who's been on this program many times, and last week talking about facial recognition software in this country, how it is being used on an unsuspecting guinea pig public. Pippa spoke about the implications for it, pre-crime, social engineering. Amazing woman, Pippa. Well, it's a big story today. I might get into it tomorrow on the program briefly. But I'm going to finish for the minute with the monologue on this story, which I came across on the BBC today. And again, it kind of ties in with some of the things that we talk about, you and I, a lot. Let me read some of this for you. Mobile phones are bad for us, writes the BBC's technical editor or technology editor. We know because every day there is a new story telling us so, or at least it can feel like that. Nobody ever actually puts their phone down after hearing these reports, though, right? What if children told you exactly how you're WhatsApping, you're Instagramming, you're emailing, and your news reading makes them feel? What if children told you how using your phone all the time makes them feel? I hate my mum's phone and I wish she never had one, is what one primary school child wrote in a class assignment. And American school teacher Jen Adams posted that comment on Facebook and revealed that 4 out of 21 of her students said they wished mobile phones had never been invented. Isn't that staggering? Isn't that startling? That 4 children out of 21 told their teacher, because of their parents' constant use of phones, those young children wished the phones were never invented. So she posted pictures of her 7 and 8 year old pupils' classwork after she asked them to describe something they wished had never been created. Now, I suppose when we were younger, we would have said guns, we would have said bombs, we would have said Brussels sprouts, probably, when we were children. Stuff that we didn't like eating, probably. Cod liver oil, we might have said. Jesus Christ. Milk of magnesia, I would have said when I was younger. Or guns. But these children said, we wish phones had never been invented. That is incredible. You see what's happening in homes. You see what's happening in children's lives. Parenting and children spending time with their parents is being broken, is being destroyed by the parents' use of phones. Now, these are 7 and 8 year olds. So presumably, they're not yet as active as they will be in terms of using phones themselves. But at this stage, they realise how much of an impact the phone is having on their relationship with their parents. It's tragic. It's tragic. Some of the parents of the children involved said it was a huge, huge wake-up call for them. Abby Fauntleroy, nothing to little Lord Fauntleroy, I don't think, but Abby Fauntleroy said, it was very, very eye-opening for me, and I'm going to spend more time now with my child and not as much time on Facebook. Jesus, the fact it didn't occur to her before. Bo Sturmer wrote that he'd seen his 2-year-old son reacting negatively when he was on his phone. I've noticed it, he said. And if I'm playing with my child and the phone rings for something and I take it, he then has nothing to do with me when I get off the phone. He sulks, does the 2-year-old, because he's pissed off. It kills me. I've made an agreement with myself that if I'm playing with him, everything else can wait. I'll tell you what, Bo Sturmer, who's not listening to this programme, presumably, and every other parent, if you've got young children, what the fuck are you doing on your phone at home? Tell your boss, tell your employers that your time is your fucking time. When you leave that company, switch it off. I say this to my partner, the aforementioned wonderful future Mrs. Allen, who works for a major, major corporation, by the way. I've told her we have rules. When she leaves her office at 5 p.m. in the evening and over the weekends, she's not to do anything for that company. She's not to be involved. She's not to check her messages. And she, not that she obeys me, she wouldn't do it anyway. It's your time with your family. Get off the phones. Crazy stuff. Wonderful. Young children are now telling their parents, listen, we're not having it anymore. Get off the phones. There might be hope for us yet. 2 minutes to the top of the hour. Welcome to your Richie Allen Show. If you're just joining it, it's brilliant to be with you. Absolutely brilliant. The author, Charlie Robinson, is standing by and joins me in a couple of minutes' time. This is going to be good. It's going to be damn good. Thanks for your tweets, by the way. Went to see this band live in Manchester back in 2005 on a balmy day at the Etihad Stadium. They were supporting Udos, U2. This is The Bravery. This is called An Honest Mistake. So while I'm chatting with Charlie Robinson, if there's something you'd like me to say to Charlie, do tweet at Richie Allen Show. Wednesday, May 23rd, 2018. Back in 2 minutes. Music from The Bravery on The Richie Allen Show. It's exactly 8 p.m. That's British summer time in Manchester. If you're listening to the podcast or listening to this on YouTube, of course it won't be 8 p.m. But I didn't need to be telling you that. I'm really, really happy that my guest this evening got in touch with the programme. I really am. And kudos to him for sending me his brand new book today, which is very exciting for listeners to this programme, because it deals with themes that we deal with, you and I, and talk about all the time. He believes that there are 8 tentacles of control that are wrapped around humanity. And those are the military, governmental, covert, physical, financial, media, spiritual and scientific. That is what they are. And he's written a book about it. He was heavily influenced by John Perkins, the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John's been on this programme many times. In fact, I met John along the road back about 10 or so years ago. Now, his own story is very interesting. He has worked in the mortgage industry in Las Vegas real estate, and presumably there he saw a lot and witnessed a lot of fraud and began to maybe understand the economic system and what it can do to people. So he's written a book called The Octopus of Global Control. It's a humorous book, very controversial in parts, and it's available at all good online retailers. It is The Octopus of Global Control. Let's welcome to the program Charlie Robinson. Charlie, you're very welcome. How are you?
I'm great, Richie. How are you doing?
I'm really well. Thanks for rushing back across town to get home to do this today. We could have done it next week, but I'm really glad that you did and you're here. And congratulations on the book. Thanks for sending it to me. I've had a speed read of the first few chapters today. It's excellent. I'm delighted you sent it to me and I'm delighted to be talking to you. Tell us about that career in real estate in Las Vegas, Charlie, and how that influenced your thinking in terms of how you began to see the world around you, your own country, geopolitics and finance. Tell us about that.
Well, first I'd like to say that it's a pleasure to speak to Manchester, because you are the home of two of my favorite bands in the world, Smiths and Oasis.
So get in.
I'm grateful for that. I grew up in the Palm Springs area. You probably don't know where that is, but you will know that it is right near Coachella. So I have a fond affection for Manchester. So the way it started for me was that I worked in new home sales in Las Vegas during the boom, 2003 to 2012, and it was madness. We saw all kinds of things. If you've seen The Big Short or you've read the book The Big Short by Michael Lewis, you'll understand. I was living that. And everything was fine up until a point, but there was a time in which the sales stalled out, and I worked for a new home builder.
Charlie, forgive me for interrupting, Charlie. I'm going to disconnect the call and reconnect it because there's an annoying buzzing noise on there and it might clear itself. In fact, it's nearly gone there now. I think it's gone, Charlie.
I unplugged my headset and plugged it back in.
All right, it's back again. So I'm going to disconnect from you just momentarily and then reconnect. My apologies for this. That noise would eventually get on. I won't swear. So we'll give him a quick call back and hopefully he's right, Charlie.
Any better?
I think it's still there, but it's not as noticeable as it was before. So, okay. It's going to work. Sorry about that. You were telling us. You were talking about The Big Short, which I did read. I read as well as saw the film. This is very interesting. What you noticed working in mortgages in Vegas? Go ahead. Back to that.
Sure. I sold new homes, and as we stalled out with the sales, the management decided that they would come up with a scheme to kickstart sales. So they had what they called incentive money. Think of it like a bucket of money. We were selling $500,000 houses. We'd have $100,000 of incentive money to play around with. I could just take that for a buyer and wipe it right off the price of the house, make it $400,000. Or we could use it for closing costs or buying down their interest rates. And all those things are normal and legal and fine. But when that wasn't enough, and when the loan program started disappearing, in order to get people qualified, we had to get creative with the ways to spend this money. So if a husband and wife came in, wanted to buy the house, but they had too much debt and didn't qualify, we would take that $100,000 bucket of money, pay off both their credit cards, pay off their car payments, and then rerun them through the system and see if they qualify. And magically they would, because they wouldn't have any debt anymore. So that is illegal. That's mortgage fraud. And I raised my hand during the sales meeting and asked my boss if he had cleared this through our legal department. And I'll never forget his answer. It was, I'd rather beg for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Wow.
And we just went, oh, shit, we're in trouble. Now, I have a real estate license at stake. So did everyone else in that room. So I had a problem with that. And I said something about it. And I was dismissed, of course. I was sort of marginalized there and then later fired for something unrelated, which was not a reason to get fired, but we knew what it was about. So I watched that. So about the same time this is happening, I'm reading John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I'm starting to understand that there's a global scam being run where the IMF and the World Bank will enslave these third world countries. They'll approach them and say, hey, we've got, we can loan you money to build a hydroelectric power plant in your country. Think of all the benefits. You'll have electricity. Your kids will be able to read at night because there will be power to the homes. It'll create jobs, all of this stuff. Now, that money never actually flows from the IMF and World Bank to the country. It goes to Bechtel, Halliburton,
yes,
multinational engineering firms like that. So they build these power plants with the knowledge that they will never pencil out. There will never be enough revenue to cover the debt. So once it's finished and the revenue isn't enough to cover the debt, they approach these people, they approach these governments much like a loan shark and say, there's a lot of money you owe us and it doesn't look like you're going to be able to pay us. So maybe we can work something out. Instead of breaking your legs with a baseball bat, why don't you vote our way in a UN resolution, or why don't you privatize your lumber industry and allow my friend to buy it from you, or why don't you allow the US to build a military base. So I saw that scam John Perkins described and then spent the better part of 20 years apologizing for it and trying to redeem himself by helping those indigenous people, which I think is fantastic. So as I'm reading his book, I'm sort of living a smaller version of that in Las Vegas. And
You are living a smaller version, but this is amazing stuff, Charlie. I'm so glad you're here to talk about this. This is huge. And it's very pertinent right now to listeners. We have thousands and thousands of listeners in the Republic of Ireland who are going through this. It's incredibly pertinent now. So what you were seeing then was people, folks, regular folks like you and me, being used by a third party, basically, to acquire land, to acquire properties. They were using people, basically, who couldn't really afford mortgages, who were going to get into trouble. Financial institutions were using them to accrue property. You were witnessing this.
Oh, yeah. I was involved in it. I remember a guy that came in and was trying to buy a house with his wife, and he literally was a guy that picked oranges. And I remember pulling him aside and saying, I know you qualify for this house, but I don't think you should buy this house. I mean, I was shooting myself in the foot, but I just couldn't I knew where it was going. I could see that this was going to be a problem. You know, you're talking about adjustable rate mortgages, and they said, well, you know, they'll adjust it at some point, maybe. No, they're going to adjust. They're going to adjust. They never explained the fine points to you. And it was a time bomb. And then at the time, it's a little difficult to understand how it's all going to play out. I felt like I had a better understanding of it. But now looking back, it's crystal clear. What happened to those houses? They got foreclosed on. The banks took possession of them. And then the hedge funds came in and bought them from the banks for 10 cents on the dollar. So now you've got Goldman Sachs, which is one of the largest owners of rental properties in the country. And that's not by accident. It's a scheme. They designed it. And another thing to remember is that the way these mortgages were done, the company that created the actual mortgage for a person never intended to hold onto it and service it. The minute that the person closed on that house and that mortgage became real, it was packaged off to Wall Street. And that's where you get for The Big Short, they explain that in detail, how all those mortgages were pooled into ones. They slapped a AAA rating on them, which was total baloney. And then they were sold off to investors. And in Goldman Sachs' case, with the Abacus Fund, sold off to investors, and then Goldman Sachs bet against it. So I mean, it's like a rigged carnival game with the most crooked carnival in town. And
the banks committed massive fraud, because as we saw in the Republic of Ireland, the bank issued mortgages they should never have issued. Then they took an insurance policy out against the mortgage going bad. So they took property. First of all, the bank didn't take any risk because they invented the loan out of thin air. They invented the money out of nothing. The money was loaned into existence, so they took no risk whatsoever. So not only have they taken a property now, which is an asset, a physical asset, but they've also gone to an insurance company and they've claimed on the defaulted mortgage. Charlie, this is evil beyond belief, and it's happening still today. And it's so important we're talking about this tonight. Your conscience, Charlie, couldn't allow you carry on and tell people, you know, because you knew these people were going to get into horrendous situations. Marriages were going to break up. People were going to commit suicide, right? I mean, terrible stuff.
Yeah. I was a salesperson. I was on commission. I was commission based 100%, but I couldn't do it. I just had a hard time. You know, I saw these people with their families. They were so excited. They were moving in. And we would see loan programs disappearing day after day after day. And it just became, well, where do we stick them? Where, you know, let's find a program. And that's a bad sign. And I think that the media was a huge role in this, because they fueled this. They fueled this. Got to get your house. You know, you don't want to be too late. And the home builders themselves did as well. On the brochures that we would hand out to people, there might be little stickers on it that would say, 5% price increase on, you know, on June 30th, you'd go, oh my God, that's 3 weeks from now.
Wow.
So that's like chumming the water for investor sharks, because they came out and said, well, if I can get 5% in 3 weeks, how many can I buy? You know, and they would buy a dozen. I sold 13 houses in one day. It was insane. And you started to realize how unsustainable it was. And I myself bought a house, got foreclosed on. You know, so I wasn't immune from this. I was drinking the Kool-Aid to a certain extent. I feel bad for the people that I sold houses to, but I also want them to know that I did it to myself as well. I was a believer. I was coming from Southern California, where the prices were double or maybe triple what they were in Las Vegas. And I thought, well, yeah, these prices are going up, but they're still nowhere near Southern California. So there's still more room. And, you know, I sold myself on that
Charlie, you're I don't know you very well, but I believe you're a nice guy. And I want to talk just briefly. Before we do, I'm going to mention this several times. I've begun reading this book today, folks. I'm not going to lie. I never lie. I haven't completed it because I received it today. That's not Charlie's fault, by the way. I asked Charlie to come on today, and he sent me the book immediately. It's a gripping read. It's The Octopus of Global Control by Charlie Robinson. I will tweet links to where you can get it. I'm recommending that you read this book if you can. It's really important stuff. Charlie, just before we go on and we talk about how you deal with the realization, and again, you talk about the tentacles, you have the media, of course, the financial institutions, we'll come to that. Greed can affect everybody, Charlie. I don't believe that I would have done any different initially if I was in your situation. I can't stand these holier-than-thou people who are critical. Look, we all have needs. We all have financial needs. We all have families. We all have bloody debt, all of us. if I'm in that situation back in the day, you know, it was like the California, you know, it was like the Wild West gold rush, I would have done it. And what I'm trying to say is, we look at the brokers now and the mortgage agents and people like yourself, and we maybe condemn them, we maybe criticise them, but they're human beings, and we all have frailties, we're all fallible. And I'm sure some pretty good people just got caught up in it, got caught up in earning the fast money and lost their sense of morality, even if it was only for a short time. But they're not evil. That's the point I'm making, I suppose. Because there will be people listening to this and they'll be saying, "Ah, Richie, come on, Charlie, you know, he played his part in all of this." But, we, you know, we're all fallible. We're all capable of doing wrong and getting excited and caught up in the gold rush. That was my point. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do have a responsibility in it for sure. I was working my ass off. I wasn't sitting back, letting it come to me. I believed in it. I was selling homes. I was watching things take off. I was watching the construction go crazy. Las Vegas is a fantastic place to live. There's no state income tax. The weather's great. You have people from all over the country moving there. There's plenty to do. The best restaurants. There's a lot to love about it. And the pricing got a bit out of control, but the pricing was getting out of control everywhere. So it wasn't limited to Las Vegas. And once it turned, I realized, uh-oh, this is bad. And I think a lot of the people that I sold houses to are going to be in a bad spot. And I felt really bad about that for a long time. And like I said, I lost my house. I lost two houses, in fact, to foreclosure. And
how difficult was that, Charlie? How difficult is it to come to terms with that? Because, you know, it's been a while since we've had somebody on the program who's had to cope with the trauma of that happening. And it's embarrassing and it's traumatic and it's devastating. How do you deal with it?
I got fired, lost my house, and got divorced all within the same 6-month period. So it was a bit rough. I think one of the reasons that I was able to deal with it was because I knew I didn't intentionally do this to people. I knew that I had come into it with the best of intentions. I'd stayed close with a lot of my buyers, and I had a lot of them that stayed friends afterwards. And they knew, like, listen, I'm a big boy. I bought this house. You didn't sell me anything I didn't necessarily want. And I never lied to people about it. I was always upfront. So I witnessed it, but I have a lot of guilt about that. And so part of the book came about because I felt an obligation to do my part. And so what I did with it was, the format of the book is I brought in quotes from 500 different people, professionals, people that had a hand in some of the most important events in world history. People like, of course, the Rothschilds and Rockefellers, but also David Icke and George Carlin and Bill Hicks and people like that. So between, you know, the topics I covered, I brought in the quotes from people to back up what I was saying, and then I added my dark sense of humor to sort of keep people hanging in there through maybe the depressing parts. Because let's face it, some of the things that we talk about, some of the things that you discuss on your show are a bit dark.
Very dark.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't ignore them. We shouldn't pretend like they don't exist. We don't have to dwell on them, but we do have to be aware of them. So my feeling was, if I can make it, if I can make people laugh in the book, keep them hanging in there a little bit longer, then they'll get through it. Because I think it's important. It was, I can't express to you how influential David Icke was in me writing this book. He turned me on to a lot of ideas and concepts that I was unaware of, and then I filled in the gaps by reading other people's work and by listening to people. I mean, I've been a listener of your show for years and years, and I'd like to thank you, by the way. Through listening to your show, I've been introduced to the work of, and then gotten to know a little bit, Dean Henderson.
Oh, Dean, of course.
Guy.
Yeah, great guy.
And John
yeah.
Hamer as well. John Hamer sent me his books, and Dean's, we've traded books between the three of us. And oh my God, those guys, I mean, I would have never heard of them if it hadn't been for your show. So
this is amazing, Charlie. And I'm sure David Icke would be thrilled and flattered to hear you say that. I'm not surprised to hear you say that. This is so when you began to see the bigger picture then, because it's a horrifying reality when you realize that this misery, and it didn't affect tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, it destroyed millions of lives. And when you began to see that it was part of a plan, it was the privatization, it was taking ownership of houses, of homes by massive financial institutions, was that when you began to look at geopolitical events and things with a different eye? Was that the turning point for you?
Absolutely. John Perkins' book made me start to look at it as a global. I thought that what was happening in the United States was an isolated event that may be just a product of a wave of a couple things hitting all at once. Low interest rates, stimulated economy, fueled by the media. I just thought that maybe I didn't realize that it was actually a pre-planned bubble expansion then contraction. And then once I started to learn about the Federal Reserve Bank and understood that the financing mechanism for the globalists is the federal are all the central banks and how they inflate bubbles then pop bubbles in order to take back physical tangible assets, I realized this is the most evil game I've ever seen, and I wanted to know more about it. Never with the intention of actually writing a book. My intention was just to know more about it. And I had a sort of, a typical conversation with my mother when I discovered some new aspect of this. And I told her about it. And she said, "This is great. What are you going to do with all this information that you have?" And I didn't know. I said, "I don't know. I didn't know I had to do anything with it." So it was one of those simple questions that like stumped me. And so I realized, well, I think maybe I'm pretty good at compiling information. So I set about to do that. I wrote the book in total secrecy in the middle of the night while my wife was asleep. She didn't know I even wrote it. When she found out I wrote it, she had accidentally intercepted the first batch of books that came.
Wow.
Opened up the box and promptly threw me out of the house for 2 days.
Wow. Do you know what? I'm thinking, Charlie, she might also have said to you, "Oh, you did very well to keep that a secret. What else are you keeping secret?"
Well, I said, "I don't have a secret life. I don't have another family in Utah. You should be happy about this." She said, "Get out."
But you know, you delve into things, and I'm going to say this, and I don't. It's very rare that I promote anything or recommend anything, but it is very well written what I've been reading so far today. And you take on some things, and I'm always fascinated meeting people whom, I mean, you get into false flag terror events, you get into the cheerleading of the media for never-ending war, the lack of, you know, any genuine questioning of what's going on. It's not easy to come to terms with stuff like that. And I'll ask you a question I ask everybody whom has done something like you've done. How do you come to terms with realizing that there are people, there are institutions in your own country that are capable of murdering people, blaming it on somebody else to further an agenda? Because it's Alice in Wonderland stuff, Charlie. It's not easy to deal with that.
No, it's horrifying when you realize that. It really tests your love for humanity. You just go, "God, is everybody, I mean, what's the point? Where are we living? Are we on, am I living on another planet? I never knew this. I never had this. I don't operate like that. I can't imagine being somebody that seeks out, to hurt other people intentionally for their gain. It was so foreign to me." And then one of the things I realized that I had to do in the book was I had to make sure there was a positive ending to it. I had to remind people, "Hey, listen, we have the numbers here. This is insane for us to think that we don't, that we're helpless here, that the game's over. It's not over. We have the numbers. We are awakening. People are starting to do something about this. That's a good thing. These people that are in control count on our ignorance. They have to, because there are so many of us and so few of them. They have to control us through the media. They have to control us through money. And got to give them credit. They've been doing a damn good job of it. But if we forget, or if we get lulled into thinking that it's over, the game's over, and we can't win, then we've walked right into their trap, because that is not the case. The awareness of these things is the first step. And then remembering that there's always the option that we can always say, we do not comply. We do not comply with your illegal orders. We will not go to war and fight people that have done nothing to us. We
Charlie, hold that thought about non-compliance, because it's one thing for military men and women to non-comply, which obviously is hugely important, but it's another thing for people in communities not only to not comply with illegal and wrongful legislation, but also to support their neighbours when their neighbours do not comply. But, and I want to talk about that in a minute. Before we get to that, there has been some questions for you. Of course, there are some good questions. One or two listeners have tweeted me about cyclical crashes. That these crashes, they tend to come every seven or so years, and that they tend, each one tends to be worse than the financial crash that preceded it. Do you see that, do you think even that we're on the verge of another massive financial crash, another one of these crash the economy and then grab all the assets that you can to pay for it? Do you think that's imminent?
I think it is, and I also think it's used for two reasons. One, it's to accumulate all the assets, but it's also used as a massive distraction from what's really going on in the world. Where you see these people that are starting to come to light about the pedophilia, the Pizzagate and things like that, politicians behaving, you know, badly. They will always keep a trick up their sleeve, which is to create something that causes a distraction to take your attention away from focusing on what they've been doing wrong. A financial meltdown is a perfect one, but it accomplishes a couple goals. It takes assets away from the common people, it puts them in the hands of the banking industry, and it also creates a distraction away from some of the other problems that are going on. So yeah, I unfortunately see that in the future. It's setting up like that. You've got a stock market that's out of control. Housing market in the United States is booming like crazy. This is like 2007 all over again. If you know what to look for, you can take a step back, be objective, and see that something big is coming. I take no pleasure in saying that. I wish I didn't feel that way, but unfortunately, that is how I feel.
Yeah, you're not fear-mongering at all. You're just calling it the way you see it, and you're not the only one. I mean, financial experts, economists have been on this program over the last 18 months saying the same thing. Charlie Robinson is our guest. His book is The Octopus of Global Control. That's The Octopus of Global Control. It's available at good online retailers. Yes, Amazon is one of those. I'll tweet a link out to it. I recommend that you check this out. How many times when writing the book were you scratching your head thinking, I shouldn't have to be writing this or saying this? Fox, CNN, BBC, Channel 4 News, Reuters, they should be dealing with this stuff, not me. How many times did you think that?
Oh, well, I gave up on them. They're just not to be trusted. I have no expectation from them. So I think early on, one of the first things I learned was about the utter corruption in the media, how they, if you remember, couple days after 9/11 on CNN, the news host said that a hijacker's passport was found blocks away from World Trade Center, if you can believe that.
Pristine.
And it was as if he couldn't believe the words were coming out of his mouth. I mean, we can't believe that. We should. How dare you try and pass that off as truth? It's insulting. So I understood pretty early on that if this information is going to get out, it's not going to come from the mainstream media. It's going to come from the alternative media. And you can tell that you guys are having a huge impact by how YouTube and Facebook and Twitter are throttling you. Because if you weren't a threat, they would leave you alone. So the fact that you're getting all of this negative attention from them, although it is frustrating and annoying and financially impacting you guys, it's also a very good sign. It means that you're doing something right that's making them very nervous.
So, Charlie, on that point, do you think Facebook, YouTube, and Google's efforts might be counterproductive? Because while they'll have some immediate success in demonetizing channels, which they have done, but what it might do is it might actually divert or direct people towards us. Because people might say, why are they going after these guys? They must be saying something interesting. Do you think that's a possibility?
That's exactly what I think. I think they've overplayed their hand. They're going to look back on this as a huge disaster for them. They're drawing more attention to it. If they really want it to go away, they should ignore it and pretend like it's not there. But by making a big deal and being the arbiter of fake news, Facebook's going to hire 20,000 people to tell you what's real and fake news. Give me a break. That's straight out of George Orwell, 1984, Ministry of Truth. I mean, this is, you know, you couldn't make it up. So they're going to look back on this as being a colossal business failure, and you're seeing people, you know, sites like CNET and DTube and, you know, rising up out of this, servicing a need and blossoming, and they should, and good for them, because they're doing what these social media networks should have been doing that aren't, and they're controlled. Then we have to understand that Facebook and Google receive financing from InQtel, which is one of it's DARPA's venture capital fund. So they had seed money coming from the spy agencies to begin with. So we really shouldn't act all that surprised that they're being used as a tool. That was the intent. They wouldn't have invested the money if they didn't have plans for them.
Yeah, the benefits that they tell you about in their lovely commercials are not the real reason these things come about or come to be. It's the stuff they're not telling you. This is really important. You take on the education system in the book. Now, this is hugely important, and it's something that comes up on this program all the time. There's a wonderful story, Charlie, on BBC News today. You wouldn't have heard me talk about this because you were racing across town, under the speed limit, by the way, but racing across town nonetheless to get back to do this. But there was a wonderful story on the BBC today about how children in the States, if I can just scroll back up, I might be able to figure out which state it is. It might have been, it might have been the city of New Orleans, actually. It might have been. But it's Louisiana. Children are telling their teachers in schools, young children, 7 and 8, that the invention they wish had never been invented was the mobile phone, was the cell phone, because it's getting in the way of their quality time with their parents, because their parents are always on the phone. This is a wonderful thing. They've asked these children to come up with the invention they wished had never been invented. And the children are saying cell phones because their parents are always on the phones. Parents are responding to this by saying, Jesus, we never knew just how bad it is, how often we're on these bloody devices. A wonderful thing. So that's a positive story coming out of Louisiana. But on the other side of it, there's a lot to be concerned about right now in terms of what's being given to and what's being told to our children in schools. And I know you take this on in the book, and this is, if you want to call it, the hidden hand or the elite or the cabal. Education is a big thing for them in terms of doing what it is they want to do and imposing this on us. They start in the schools. Tell us more about that, Charlie.
Yeah, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, you had Rockefeller and Carnegie heavily financing the school system. So there must be something that happens when you make more money than you know what to do with. You get to the point where you want to have some say in the educational system. Now, they weren't doing this to benefit humanity. They were doing this to create a race of workers for them, which is why you have classrooms with desks that are set in straight lines, and you have the ringing of the bell when it's time, you know, when the class is over, when school's over. It's to create a factory mentality. And they teach these kids starting from kindergarten all the way through high school to respond to a bell, very Pavlovian. And then and then they educate them in a way that keeps them, as George Carlin says, smart enough to work the machine, but not smart enough to realize how screwed they're getting. And now you take Bill Gates and his Gates Foundation and the implementation of Common Core, and you get into a whole new world of that. I know you've had Duke Pesta on many times in the show.
Duke,
and I quote him in the book. He's fantastic. Common Core was set up in a way that the states would accept grant money from the Obama administration, but it was contingent upon them implementing Common Core. If they decide later that they don't want Common Core, they have to pay that money back. So they're stuck. You know, you've got school systems that are broke to begin with, so they're not in a position to give money back if they've taken it. So you have them implementing Common Core, and Common Core is, there's only one logical way to a conclusion to come to, and that it is designed to confuse kids. You can, if you ask a kid what 3 times 4 is, and the kid says 12, they'll get it wrong unless they show their work, unless they show 1,100 steps to, you know, to come to an answer. If they come to an answer and the answer is 11, which is wrong, they'll get partial credit because they're interested in the process of how that worked. Now, think about how difficult school is for a kid under the best circumstances, how stressful and traumatic. And then you add the fact that 3 times 4 is 12 and you get that marked wrong, and you get the kids are coming home crying, they don't want to go to school anymore. You have to wonder, why is that? It's by design. It's to screw up the kids to the point
scrambling the brain, Charlie.
Scrambling their brains, yeah, and creating doubt and leaving them in a position where they feel like they cannot excel at anything, creating this class of just substandard kids, and that's the next generation. And it's evil, and it's been set up by design.
And Charlie, sorry to interrupt, yeah. Charlie. At the same time, they're saying to youngsters, oh, by the way, you might not be a boy, or you might not be a girl. Did you ever think about that? And these are children, you know, they should be kicking a football, they should be chasing a basketball, knocking a softball over the heads of their classmates, running around chasing one another, as well as learning to read and write, full stop. But to be asking them to consider stuff like this, can you tell me this, Charlie, in your research, how aware are parents of what's going on? Let's just take the garden variety parents who's sending their child to a grade school, we call them primary schools here. How much do the parents know about what's going on in those classrooms?
Almost nothing. They're too busy working.
Yeah.
Both parents are working. They've got kids at the school. They'd love to be more involved, but they don't have the time, and they don't have the financial capacity to have one parent stay at home and be involved. If they went to the school, I had a friend who was a second grade teacher in Las Vegas, in an area of Las Vegas that was really socioeconomically deprived. She had a parent-teacher conference day, and the way they did is they scheduled it. Parents come every half hour. They have a scheduled time. She had 24 kids in her class. One parent showed up.
One?
One.
Just one. Wow.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't that they didn't love their kids. It's that they were at work, you know? It's that they didn't have the ability to pull away for a little bit of time to meet with the teacher. And even if they did, what were they going to do about it? What were they going to say? How are they going to improve things? I mean, that was heartbreaking to me. But I don't think that's an isolated case. I think there's a lot of parents that just have said, listen, you go to school, learn as much as you can, not understanding. Nobody is explained how Common Core works. That is, you know, not getting to the parents.
No, of course
not. Because once it is, they're up in arms about it. And then, of course, the whole gender identity confusion. Oh, my God, I couldn't even imagine being a kid these days and having all of that. So it can be a very confusing time, I think. And so
you explained, Charlie, you explained earlier on perfectly why parents can't be aware of it, because they are one, possibly two missed paychecks away from Skid Row. It's as simple as that. I think of my close friends, like most people, you've only got maybe one or two or three really, really close friends. And I think of the people I know, they're good people, they're intelligent people, they work hard. But like me, Charlie, they've got no savings. I'm 43 right. years old, I have no savings. I'm not ashamed of that. You know, most people wouldn't admit that, but I'm not ashamed of it. I've no savings. So if things go south for me, I rely on the future Mrs. Allen. If things go south for her at the same time, we're on the street, Charlie. And that's the way most people are. This is the debt slavery that you've described brilliantly earlier on and that you describe in the book. So of course they can't be involved in what's actually being told to their children. Man, this is lunacy.
Yeah, you have one thing though that a lot of people do not have. And that is that you are doing something that you love. And you're very good at it. So,
thanks for that. Yeah,
there's value there. I understand the stresses of that. Yeah, you're right. You know, one thing goes bad, it's trouble.
For most people, right, Charlie? I mean, you've researched this diligently. This is for most people outside of the people who work for the system, in the system, in finance and media. The rest of us are hand to mouth. I'm not poor. We're not poor. We can rent. You know, we have the house that we rent. We put food on the table every week. There's only the two of us. We're not poor, but, you know, I think we are like most people in terms of that. If it goes bad for a couple of months, well, it's impending disaster. And you've written about this, and you are certain that this is by design. We are hooked up to this debt umbilical cord, this debt slavery.
Yeah, and I think once people understand the mechanisms of the bank, which we're not taught, by the way, in school. Once they understand that, then it becomes, then they start to get it a little bit more when they realize that there's not enough money to service all of the debt out there. Not, not in a theoretical way, but in an actual way. The way if you go back to dollar zero and you create $100 and you loan it to someone at 6% interest, they have to pay you $106 the next year, and there's not that $6. So it becomes this perpetual cycle, like a Ponzi scheme or a carnival game. And it's been used. I mean, this is the reason why central banks have been thrown out of countries. Thomas Jefferson was adamant that they would destroy you. So he threw them out, 200 years ago, and they came back in 1913 in the U.S. And by watching that, by understanding that this is a game, an evil game, but it's set up in a way that benefits the banks, and then witnessing the countries, the list of countries that did not have central banks and that wound up getting invaded in like one after another, it becomes very clear that there's a plan. And if you're one of the three countries now that doesn't have a central bank, like Cuba, North Korea, or Iran, you better watch yourself, because they're going to manufacture a reason to go in, demonize you, invade your country, and impose a central bank, just like they did in Libya, Iraq, and Afghanistan over the last couple of years.
Charlie Robinson is our guest. We've got 10 minutes left, and I'm going to give those 10 minutes to Charlie, because there might be something he wants to talk about that we haven't yet covered. So, Charlie, think about what you might want to talk about. I just want to mention again, I've tweeted a link to the book. It is called The Octopus of Global Control. Controversial, realistic, devastating, funny as well, though. Bringing together these eight tentacles of control that enable those responsible for the paradigm that we exist in to control us effectively. It's terrific stuff. The Octopus of Global Control. It's available at all good online retailers. Of course, Amazon, which is the most common one here in this country. I'm recommending you check it out. And the Kindle edition of it is great value. That's all I'm going to say. Great value. You might want to get on to Amazon about the price in there, Charlie. But it's good. It's good value. Listen, is there some aspect of this that you want to chat about in the 10 minutes that we have left that maybe we haven't covered yet? And it's been terrific listening so far. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I want to say that this is not some new phenomenon. This has been going on for years and years. And like I said, when I wrote the book, I brought in the quotes from people to back up what I was saying. So I want to read something. This is from a man named John Francis Hyland. He says, "The real menace of our republic is the invisible government, which like an octopus sprawls its slimy legs over our cities, states, and nation. To depart from mere generalizations, let me say that at the head of this octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests and a small group of powerful banking houses, generally referred to as the international bankers. The little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run the United States government for their own selfish purposes. They practically control both parties, write political platforms, make cat's paw of party leaders, use the leading men of private organizations, and resort to every device to place in nomination for high public office only such candidates as will be amenable to the dictates of corrupt big business. These international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of the newspapers and magazines in this country. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques which compose the invisible government. It operates under cover of a self-created screen and seizes our executive officers, legislative bodies, schools, courts, newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection." Now, that quote is from 1922.
Wow.
So almost 100 years, nothing's changed. They're still running that game. They've got control of everything, and that's how they impose this on the people.
He nailed it, Charlie. He nailed the electoral system, which is completely redundant. I'm tired of saying to people, stop getting excited about Jeremy Corbyn. Stop getting excited about Bernie. You know, feel the burn. Give me a break, people. When are you going to wake up to it? This is the thing, Charlie. How many more duds are going to come in talking about real change and then give you the same shit that you've been served up all your life before people realise that system has to be basically dismantled?
Well, I've got a great quote here for you that you might like. It says, "The cabal's greatest tool, the biggest power that they have, is our incredulity, our conditioning to believe that certain things just can't happen." That is from Richie Allen.
Yeah, I vaguely remember saying that, yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's our incredulity, the fact that people think, no, it can't be true. they can't possibly, you know, such a tiny cabal can't possibly control everything. But you're right, that is central, Charlie, to how it is they thrive and survive, is that people shake their heads and say, I just can't be right. But you said earlier, and please God you're right, Charlie, that increasing numbers of people are starting to think again.
Yeah, for sure. We witnessed, I think people are understanding that the politicians are puppets. They're not really the ones in charge. We had two of the worst candidates in the history of the United States election run for president. And so, you know,
ever.
And so we act surprised when we get, maybe we're getting exactly what we deserve. Maybe we don't deserve a good candidate. Maybe, you know, I look at us on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, with all the morons lined up to beat down the doors of a Walmart to get a $3 can opener. And I think, you know what, maybe we're getting exactly what we deserve. Maybe we haven't earned it.
That's a brilliant image. And yeah, and it's not cruel either. It's true. And those people who behave like that, they deserve our scorn. They also deserve our friendship and our help and our counsel when we can. But those sorts of activities deserve our absolute scorn. Yeah, we're drowning in a sea of identity politics. You know, it's getting more and more polarized, left versus right. On the one hand, but on the other hand, you're right. More people are starting to see, well, no, in fact, we're screwed every time, no matter what. You know, you mentioned David Icke earlier. David tells a great story about when Obama was running for president. It coincided with David being in the US. He was on the West Coast, which is obviously traditionally very liberal. It's very much democratic, socialist minded. And when he was given a talk, he was being true to himself. And he was saying that, oh, if this Obama guy gets in, you know, you're not going to see any change at all. This is complete nonsense. This is mind control on a huge scale. And the mood went sour very quickly in the auditorium. People were disgusted, you know. They're like, what, Ike? Surely Ike should be, this is a black man, an African-American. Surely Ike should see that this guy is going to bring real change. And David is like, no, but you've obviously not been reading my books for years. You know, it's not going to change things. And some people left. Go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because his slogan was hope.
Hope, yeah. But
there's an interesting thing about hope. Hope is always in the future. It's never in the present. You never have to actually deliver on it. As long as it's out there, it's out there in the future. So it was brilliant for him. It was, of course, a fraud, but it was brilliant to put that hope out there, because as long as you have that, it's like the carrot that you're chasing, you know. But you never really have to give them that. It's always somewhere just outside of your grasp.
Yeah, it's a carrot.
A little harder.
It's a carrot on a stick that's dangling ever out of reach. Before we run out of time, we touched briefly on, and I'm so glad you brought it up, non-violent civil disobedience. We need to completely say no. But more than that, we have to start to become friendly with and engage with our immediate neighbours again, the man or woman living next door, the person across the street, because their struggles are your struggles. So if they decide not to comply, no, this tax is illegal, I'm not going to pay it, and I'm not going to bow down to your threats to repossess my car or whatever. We need to stand with people, don't we, Charlie?
Absolutely. And we have to understand that red team versus blue team mentality is set up by the people in control to keep us divided. And it works like a charm. They do it with religion. They do it with politics, because it divides us into smaller and smaller groups. And if you're in a smaller group, you feel like you don't have as much power. If everyone takes a step back and realizes that we're all on the same team here, we're all people that love our family and want the best for our future, and we want all this stuff nonviolently, we realize we have a whole hell of a lot more in common than we do apart from one another. So to remember that, yeah, there's strength in numbers. There's a great scene in that cartoon movie A Bug's Life when the grasshoppers talk about stomping out the ants and saying you have to stomp them out, because if they realize they outnumber us 1,000,000 to 1, it's over for us. And that's what we need to remember.
I must grab that clip. I've not seen that film, Charlie. Presumably you've children or youngsters, so that's you got to see it. I didn't see it. That's a lovely way to leave it, but I'm going to ask you to come back. I'm going to give you a shout again in 6 or 8 weeks to get you to come back. and have a chat with us if you're up for that. I am going to plug the book again, though. It is The Octopus of Global Control by Charlie Robinson. I managed to read a good 25, 30 pages this afternoon, and it is terrific. And even somebody like myself, this is important, and I've heard a lot of people on this programme and other programmes for years. There is new information, and there are new conclusions and analogies drawn by Charlie in the book that are new to me. So there's a lot of new stuff in there. Check it out. All good online retailers, The Octopus of Global Control. Thanks for your time, Charlie. I've loved having you on, and I really look forward to you coming back on again in the future. Congratulations on the book. As we say in Ireland, fair play to you for writing it and doing it. And I look forward to doing it again.
Thank you so much, Richie. I will be on whenever you'd like me to come back.
Brilliant stuff, Charlie. Thanks so much. That was Charlie Robinson, The Octopus of Global Control. Check it out. Available at all good online retailers, as I said. Now, check it out there. Thanks to Charlie for coming on. Right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have a quick scroll through the tweets. And we'll have to move on swiftly because time is against us.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Right, that's me then. It happened. It happens every now and then. I was responding to a message there and I forgot we were back. We're back. Welcome back. It's 8.5 minutes to the top of the air. This is your Richie Allen show, of course, on Fab Radio 2, richieallen.co.uk, TuneIn Radio and other platforms as well. Dave from the Sex Pistols Experience. Good evening, Dave. Sex Pistols Experience, which I missed in Manchester last year, but they are back in the autumn in Manchester at the Academy, and I won't be missing them. Just got that message today, Dave. I was going to respond to it a bit later on. Sex Pistols Experience, can't wait to see them in this great city and meet the guys again, whom I met at the David Icke talk at the Apollo Theatre about 18 months ago. Hi to Tiger. Les Hewitt said, by the way, interesting enough, Les says, if North Korea gave up nuclear weapons, the US will invade within months. That's an interesting perspective, and you might not be wrong there. Moinga said he was impressed with Charlie's understanding of hope, because Charlie said hope is always in the future, it's never in the present. Brilliantly said, Charlie. Charlie was absolutely right, of course, and when politicians take to the airwaves, when they're on the stump, it's they deal in cliches, monumental bollocks. Hope, change you can believe in. Bollocks. It'll change, all right. It'll get worse. Faisal is talking about schooling and education, and he says that's what homework always was. Let me just bring that up there, because that looks interesting. David Stanford had tweeted, pushing kids to a point of breakdown until they need a bit of IG Farben sweeties. That's, of course, the likes of Ritalin and tablets. Faisal, responding to that, said that's what homework always was. If you don't have an ideal home life, homework and its enforcement will turn that into an ordeal. Well, a friend of mine, I won't mention him by name because he might not like me to mention him, went to his son's primary school recently and said enough was enough with the homework. That his young son was coming home with bucket loads of homework. And my friend, you can probably guess who it is, but I'm not going to say who it is because he might not want me to say, went to his son's school and said, listen, enough. And the school said, all right, they backed down. And that's the thing, you see. Stand up to these people. Why is he screwed? Why is he stressed coming home on Fridays with loads of homework? I'll tell you what he's going to do on Saturday and Sunday. He's going to be out with me and his mum. Not poring over books, you crazy person. That's what my friend said to the head teacher. And the head teacher backed down. Proper order. Proper order, we say in Ireland. This is another great Irish sentence. Proper order. You know, if we are blessed with children in the future, first of all, we won't be in the UK, we're gone. And that's the truth, I've said this before. Number two, the child will never enter the front door of any school anywhere. We will teach our child how to read, how to write, and we will teach them to explore this incredible environment, this wonderful world around us, and figure it out for themselves with a little bit of encouragement and a little bit of guidance here and there. But they won't be going to any school. They won't be having any vaccinations. Speaking of that, I've invited Rima Labo back on the programme tomorrow night, not to talk about vaccinations or any of that. We're going to talk broadly, more broadly, about autoimmune diseases. We're going to talk about autism as well. The terrific GP MD Rima Labo back on this programme tomorrow to have a chat with us. I'm looking forward to that. It's been quite a while since she was on. If you're just joining the programme at the very end of it, interesting chat earlier on about the Irish abortion referendum. You can catch that on the podcast, which will be online really soon, and the YouTube videos in the AM, put on YouTube by my friend Simon Stewart. Top man is Simon. There was something, oh yeah, and the big story, of course, developing, is that Yulia Skripal has emerged and has recorded a statement on video somewhere near London in a very nice leafy place. Maybe. Somewhere like Surrey, maybe. She could be in Surrey somewhere. And she's spoken in Russian to her handlers who have released that video to the police. She's alive and well, taking things one day at a time. We're lucky we survived the assassination attempt, she said, but we won't be returning to Russia anytime soon. The more conspiracy-minded amongst us have been tweeting me to tell me they don't believe it. Right, that's okay. You can believe whatever you want. I'm going to love you and leave you. I tell you what I'm going to do now. In the absence of the great Caroline, my partner, my soulmate, who isn't here, she's in France. Right now, she's at a table in a fancy restaurant being wined and dined by her oldest friends and her dearest family. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have a little glass of something strong, just one. And I'm going to toast her and ring her later on, pissed. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ring her later on and wish her again a happy 40th birthday. Look after yourselves and one another. Thanks to my guest. Really enjoy Charlie Robinson. Check out his book, The Octopus of Global Control. Check it out. I will talk to you again tomorrow at the usual time. In the meantime, as usual, look after yourselves and one another. Great to see those children telling their parents to get rid of their mobile phones, eh? There's hope for us yet. Gonna leave you with Depeche Mode and enjoy the silence. See you tomorrow.